Let's turn to Judges chapter 2 initially. Judges chapter 2, and then we'll turn over and look at the very familiar story of Gideon and the Midianite armies. Just remind me again of when this, when's our coffee at 10:15? When's the next thing on the program? 10:45 is the coffee. All right. Okay. Good. Judges chapter 2 and verse 10. And this picks up after the death of Joshua. After that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Ashtoreths. In his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around whom they were no longer to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them they were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders, yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshipped them. Unlike their fathers, they quickly turned from the way in which their fathers had walked, the way of obedience to the Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers, following other gods and serving and worshipping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. Therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel and said, "Because this nation has violated the covenant that I laid down for their forefathers and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. I will use them to test Israel and see whether they will keep the way of the Lord and walk in it as their forefathers did." The Lord had allowed those nations to remain. He did not drive them out at once by giving them into the hands of Joshua. And then into chapter 3, these are the nations that God allowed to remain so as to test the people. I don't know if you've done a series on Judges at all. I never have. I'm not brave enough to even attempt it. There's certain books that I have sort of tied up with sellotape, and that somehow or another I just get onto the next section. But the story of Judges is frankly a quite depressing story, and the reason we read from chapter 2 is in order that we would get the flavor of that. The judges, of course, are a sign of God's grace and kindness to his people, as the story makes clear. God gave them these judges, and as long as they paid attention to them, and then they made progress. But even the judges themselves weren't that great. And the way in which the story of the judges has largely been dealt with, whether it's Samson or Gideon or whatever else it is usually just a kind of Sunday school form of moralism that says, Gideon was a great guy, why wouldn't you be a great guy as well? And maybe you'd like to grow your hair, Samson, and so on. But Wilcock puts it accurately when he says that the story of Judges is the recurring cycle of rebellion, retribution, repentance, and rescue. And as God comes and does the same thing again, then as soon as it's like children getting a smack for being naughty to their brother, and they say, "They'll never do it again, I'll never do it again, please, please, I will never do it again." And then you've only left the room 2 minutes, and then they did it again. Then you have to come in and start the whole cycle all over. Well, we ought not to be too surprised by that. We certainly ought not to immediately take the high ground, because that's actually the story of many of our Christian lives, that we tell the Lord that we're definitely going to be over this now, and all of a sudden we're back to where we were when we began. Now, I'm going to again be selective in the way I deal with things, but I would like, if possible, to do the whole of 6 and 7. Foolishness. Who would ever attempt such a thing? Only a clown. Well, here he is standing before you. And we'll just careen through it. And if we come to a grinding halt, I'll see your eyes glaze over, as happened last evening. I should say yesterday afternoon, not last evening. As a Freudian slip, that was actually a personal confession. I was at one point when I was addressed directly by John last evening. I had this horrible feeling, am I dreaming or is this actually happening? And I was dreaming, but somehow or another I pulled out the correct answer. I couldn't believe it. I was thoroughly proud of myself. It was no reflection on the wonderful paper which I'm taking back to Cleveland to plagiarize in the first conference I attend. But it was by the end of the day yesterday, it was daunting. So, but here we are, it's a new day, and there's no sense in thinking about opening the windows after the phenomenal display last evening. That was one of the great anticlimaxes of my life. Now, John has asked if I would explain to you something of what I'm doing as I'm going along, which I'm not sure I can. I think it'll be perfectly obvious what I'm doing, and you can learn antithetically. The first 10 verses of Judges 6, I start to summarize under a heading. I wrote down in my notes, deep trouble, deep trouble. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. They were in deep trouble. And at the most obvious level, as you read on, the impoverished nature of their lives, they're hiding away in mountain clefts and caves and strongholds. We have to remember when we read these things that we're dealing with history, that we're dealing with real people in a real moment in time, that there were mums and dads and grandparents, grandchildren being put to bed at night because their grandpa was babysitting for them, and they were asking questions as children do before they go to sleep. And if they were versed in the things of God, then they would be inquiring of their grandpa and even of their dad. Dad, do you think those dreadful people are going to come again this year? Oh, well, I don't know, son, but we're going to go up in the mountains just like last time. Do we have to go back in that dreadful cave, Dad? Why are we not strong enough to resist these people? Don't we believe in the living God? Yes, we do, but I think it's time for you to go off to sleep now. Stop asking such dreadful questions. But I don't like it, Daddy, in the cave. I think it's terrible up there. I think we look stupid up there. I don't know why we're hiding away. You told me that you trusted in the living God and that God had promised that he would fulfill his purposes. Yes, I know, son, but just roll over in your bed now and get off to sleep. I have to go down. Your mother's waiting for me. And then as he walks down the stairs, he says to himself, essentially, you know, that is the problem. I've really got nothing to say to little Levi at all. We are in a dreadful predicament. We really are. Midian, verse 6, so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. The Midianites were there as the tool, as it were, of God's providence. And as they impoverished them to a great extent, then they cried out. It's God in verse 1 who gave them into their hands, gave his people into their hands. And then they cried out to the Lord. It was in the experience of their weakness, their impoverishment, the fact that they were oppressed, that they were overrun, that there was nobody could ever say that they had it under control. And then they cried out to the Lord. And verse 7, when the Israelites in this deep trouble cried out to the Lord because of Midian, he sent them a prophet. It's an interesting answer, isn't it? I've got a couple of Ralph Davis quotes. It's impossible to do this without Ralph Davis. At least for me it is. But I tried to keep the book closed for as long as I possibly could. But I couldn't resist this one. He says in relationship to the sending of the prophet, he says, like a stranded motorist calling for roadside assistance and the garage sending out a philosopher instead of a mechanic, these people cried for victory over their enemies and God sent them a prophet. In other words, his answer to their predicament was in his word. His answer was in His Word. What they needed to be able to do was understand why they were in the position they were in. God knows our need. Israel senses the need because of the immediate circumstances that prevail. They sense their need for deliverance from the predicament, and God sends them someone to explain why they're in the predicament in the first place. We may look around at the challenges of our day. We say we're really in a dreadful predicament and we would like to get out of the predicament, but maybe we don't understand how we got ourselves into it in the first place. God is committed to His Word. It's a lamp to our feet, a light to our path. And the prophet comes and stands up and brings a word of reminder, doesn't he? He sent the prophet who said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Remember what I did. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I snatched you from the power of Egypt," and so on. And not only I want you to remember what I did, but I want you to remember what I told you. Verse 10, "I said to you, I am the Lord your God, and do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live, but you have not listened to me." But you have not listened to me. And just when we might expect it, that the second word in verse 11, at least in the NIV, was exactly as it is except for the final consonant. In other words, that it begins, we expect verse 11 to begin, "Don't we, the anger of the Lord came." But actually it says, "The angel of the Lord came." This is a typo. "The angel of the Lord. I am the Lord your God. I told you this. I told you that. I did this for you. You haven't listened to me. The anger." No, "the angel of the Lord." Mercy when we deserve judgment. In the face of our rebellion, remarkably, He displays His grace. And He dispatches someone to come to His servant Gideon and enable him in a battle that he is so painfully inadequate for. The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak that belonged to Joash, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. It's a dreadful situation. It just is such a picture of inadequacy and impoverishment. You imagine him playing on his stereo My Fair Lady and singing to himself, "All I want is a room somewhere," you know. Here I am stuck in this dreadful predicament here, and the angel comes. Now, I tried to summarize the next section with another two-word phrase with an exclamation point beyond it, and I simply wrote down, "Good question." Good question. The angel of the Lord comes, and Gideon's circumstances clearly don't match the greeting that he receives. "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." You can imagine him looking over his shoulder. Maybe you've come to the wrong house. And then here comes the good question. It's actually a series, really. "But sir," Gideon replied, "if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? If the Lord is with us, why?" And then actually, "if the Lord is with us, where? Where are all the wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, 'Didn't the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?'" And then thirdly, keeping question on question, "Didn't the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian." Now, if you think for a moment about what God did in answer to their cry for help in sending a prophet, you realize how important, if you like, the prophetic interpretation was in light of the questions that Gideon was asking. The answer had already been provided in the word of the prophet. And God is His own interpreter, if you like, and He makes things plain. Why are we in the predicament we're in? Why has this happened to us? Where are the things that should have been happening? The things that happened in the past? Did the Lord bring us up out of Egypt only to abandon us in this way? The answer of the angel, a pre-incarnate manifestation of Yahweh, which is, as you see, sometimes it's the angel who speaks, the Lord who speaks, the way in which that unfolds. The answer is, have you been listening to a thing? Didn't you realize what God has said? And so the Lord, you'll notice, the angel, the Lord now in verse 14, the Lord turned to him and said, go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Go in the strength you have.
Is this some kind of joke?
The strength I have? Look at me. Look at the whole shooting match. Look at us all here. A motley crew. A pathetic little group. Hiding up in the hills and in the caves. And down you come and meet with us and speak to us. And then you give me this exhortation. Go in the strength you have and save Israel. But Lord, says Gideon, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I'm the least in my family. That's a good question. How can I save Israel? I am totally inadequate. I'm completely useless. You know that we never realize just the extent of God's adequacy, do we, until we realize how hopeless we are. And that's verse 16. The Lord answers, I know you're totally inadequate, but I am completely adequate. I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites together. Now that little phrase is all he has to go on. I will be with you. There's hints of Moses in Exodus 3. Same kind of thing. Moses, I'd like you to head out and speak to Pharaoh. And Moses, of course, responds with reticence. And eventually God says to him, I want you to go, and I will be with you. Affirm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in his excellent word. Remember the phraseology? And I will be with you in trouble to bless and sanctify to you your deepest distress. I will be with you, the promise of God's presence to his servant. If you've taken your children in for surgery ever, you probably were barred early on in the British system or the Irish system in America because you're largely paying for everything. You can go where you want. And I have twice been with my girls right into the operating room. I mean, they finally send you out, but you can stay there virtually to the last moment. And the reason I went with them was because they wanted their father to be with them. All they wanted to know was that I would be with them. Will you be with me? Because the lights are scary, the masks are scary. Dad, the whole thing is scary. I want you just to tell me that you will be with me. Now, it's not sentimentalism to say this in relationship to the presence of God Almighty with us. Surely the promise of Jesus in the upper room discourse is that if a man loves me, he will keep my commandments, and I too will love him, and I will come, and I will show myself to him. Actually, he says it twice, doesn't he? And on the other occasion, he says, and my Father too will love him, and we will dwell with him. Practicing in the phraseology of old Brother Lawrence, practicing the presence of God. Some of us, because of the background out of which we come, we like to, you know, just cast about with ideas of pietism and set aside certain things, taking to ourselves some kind of theological high ground. I fear we may be taking ourselves out of the game. And we make fun, I think, at least I move in circles where they make fun of songs like I Come to the Garden Alone. I mean, I don't know what, I'm not particularly keen on this song, but the sense that the notion of it, and he walks with me, and he talks with me, and he tells me that I am his own, is frankly not something I'm prepared to give up to my charismatic friends. I'm not going to allow them the territory to tell me that they know this, and that I'm left with a sterile form of orthodoxy that keeps God at arm's length from me. The promise of God to his servant in the face of inadequacy was the promise of his presence. He had given him instruction, he had reminded him through his word, and he promised him his presence. How can I do this? I'm the least in the family, I'm the weakest of the whole group. I will be with you. And we're going to go on and do this together. Now in verse 17, in light of, and this is the third thing I wrote down, actually, is big challenge. So, big challenge. And Gideon immediately introduces his favorite word, which is if. If now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that is really you talking to me. And please don't go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you. And the Lord said, I'll wait until you return. And a wonderfully gracious response. Please don't go away. You won't go away, will you? No, I'll be here when you get back. Will you be home? Will you be in when I come home? Yes, I'll be here for you. Now that little section I'm going to avoid. I'm just going to pass over the broth and the meat and the and it's a nice little section, but you can handle that on your own. What I want to do is go to the challenge that is set before him, which is to tear down the altar of his father's house. And that comes there in verse 25, after the little meal, after the gourmet work on the part of Gideon, and the building of an altar in verse 24. At that same night, the Lord said to him, take the second bull from your father's herd, the one 7 years old, and tear down your father's altar to Baal, and cut down the Asherah pole beside it, and then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God. In other words, he said, Gideon, you need to understand the incongruity of two altars existing side by side. The altar that you've now built in verse 24, and the one that exists right in the heart of your environment, and right really in the heart of your family. What he's doing here is he's calling Gideon to nail his colors to the mast, isn't he? He says, Gideon, this is what it's going to involve. You're going to have to stand up and be counted. You're going to have to stand up and identify yourself. You are not going to be able to proceed in this sort of middle of the road, quasi-committed form. So this is what I want you to do. Quite a staggering thought, isn't it? I mean, I remember going to the home of a young fellow in Edinburgh years ago when I was assistant at Charlotte Chapel. And the reason I'd gone there is because he was a university student and he was going to be baptized at Charlotte Chapel, and his mum and dad had really gone quite south on the whole idea. I remember they never let me inside the house. I stood out freezing and standing right on the doorstep as the father gave me what for about this dreadful influence that apparently I was having on his son. I didn't hardly know his son, but I took it for Derek and for the rest. But there at the very heart of his home was a dilemma for him. I can't even remember how we resolved the question. But I remember thinking, goodness me, what a tough thing to have your father totally opposed to your commitment and to have to make a decision. It's something that will undermine my father's views. And this is what he's supposed to do. I want you to go and take care of the problem. And so Gideon in verse 27... I love this. So Gideon took 10 of his servants. It's safety in numbers. Maybe he was on the phone to a few of them. I said, I'm going over to tear down the Asherah pole, and I wondered if you'd like to come. Oh no, sorry, I'm bending down. I won't be able to come. I'm tying my laces. I can't come. And eventually he rustles up 10 of his servants, and probably commandeered them, commanded them. And he does so at night. Because he was afraid of his family and the men of the town, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. I really like this. This is one of the most encouraging things of all. It's the idea of you're a servant of God, you know, you get up and get on and full gaze of everybody and here we go, you know, we'll take it on. Which is my second Davis quote. He says, evidently, obedience was essential and heroism was optional. It's a wonderful reminder. I wish I could come up with one decent sentence before I die. Really terrific, you know. And he's getting by with a little help from his friends. And he does what he's asked to do. And the knock-on effect with his dad is quite interesting. When the men of the town, realizing what's been done, get a hold of Joash and say, you know, you should bring out your boy because we're going to have to kill him. Look what he's done to Baal's altar. And he's cut down the Asherah pole beside it. And Joash, I mean, responds intriguingly, doesn't he? He says, are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save Baal?
if Baal really is a god, don't you think he can defend himself? The guys must have said, oh, so you're in on it as well, Joash, huh? He wasn't in on it. But his boy had stood up in this case of righteousness. And it obviously had some kind of immediate knock-on effect in his life. It said, wow! And they came and said, he should die. And he said, you know, if this guy really is a god, he can fix his own Asherah pole. He can fix his own altar. You fellas don't need to worry about it. I like that too. The fourth thing I wrote down as a heading was great patience. Great patience. The patience being on the part of God. Great patience on the part of God. Because in verse 33, all the Midianites, the Amalekites, the other eastern peoples have all joined forces. They've crossed over the Jordan. They've camped in the valley of Jezreel. And the Spirit of the Lord has come upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, summoning the Abiezrites to follow him. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh, calling into arms and into Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali, and so they too went up to meet them. And then Gideon comes up with his favorite word again. Gideon said to God, if... Remember, there's a fellow called Roger Whittaker who used to sing a song called "And I Don't Believe in If Anymore." I don't know if any of you old boys remember that, but I had no clue what it meant, and it struck me that probably that was why he whistled every so often, because he had no clue what it meant either. Which introduces the intriguing thought of whistling every so often during our sermons. But Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand as you have promised. So Gideon is not doing the standard American bumper sticker approach to theology. God says it, I believe it, that settles it. He's not doing that. I was in a conference with a black pastor not so long ago, and he said, I tell my people God says it, and that settles it. I don't care if you believe it or not. And I said, okay, well, you just took it up another notch. But Gideon here is, Gideon's not there. Gideon's not in the, God says it, I believe it, that settles it, brigade. Because as much as he might want to be there, perhaps, he just isn't there. And the fact of the matter is that in many of our struggles, and in the face of our personal inadequacies, and in the battles that we fight, quite frankly, we're not often there ourselves, if we're very honest. I mean, our congregation might think we are. They think that, you know, we have that up on the wall. That's our screensaver on our laptops. And we just proceed in that way. But we proceed on our knees. We proceed falteringly. And we understand the trembling Gideon here. I know what you've said, God, but I just would be very grateful if you could give me some indication. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to put a wool fleece on the threshing floor, and if the dew is only on the fleece and the ground is dry, then I'll know that you're going to actually do what you said. It's a remarkable thing, isn't it? God has spoken, and here he comes and says, if you really mean what you said. Our wives don't want us to do that, do they? No one comes to say, well, if you really mean what you said. They hope that when they say it, that we believe them because we've built confidence and trust in them over time. And God, presumably the same way, I've spoken to you and I've said this. Yes, but this is honestly the case when we know ourselves to be the least and among the fewest and the inadequate one and not the mighty warrior at all. And verse 38, and that's what happened. And Gideon rose early the next day and he squeezed the fleece and wrung out the dew, and there was a bowl full of water. You can't believe it when you read this for the first time. You look at verse 39. Then Gideon said to God, just one thing more. Do not be angry with me. I just got one more for you. I just one more test for the fleece. Could we reverse it? I mean, that was fairly easy. I was thinking about it when I went to sleep. That's not too hard to do. I think that you can fake that. I mean, let's try it the other way around this time. What we want is dry fleece, wet ground. And that night God did so. And only the fleece was dry, and all the ground was covered with dew. Now, searching for some kind of way to earth this, when I was thinking about it, my mind went to a story that I heard at the Banner of Truth conference. I've only ever been to one Banner of Truth conference ever, which was actually a day conference in Carlisle. And on that occasion, Eric Alexander gave an address from Nehemiah in which he outlined the nature of a biblical teaching ministry, which became a booklet that some of you probably have. If you don't, it's good to find the edits. It's didactic in its nature, it's expository in its form, it's hortatory in its application, and it was a really very, very good piece of work. And he was then followed by Douglas MacMillan after coffee. And Douglas MacMillan, if you ever heard him preach, did not stay within the tram lines very often. And so everything that Eric had said about this erudite way to approach the exposition of Scripture, Douglas MacMillan just blasted out of the room, which was a terrific encouragement to me, because I at a coffee time I said, I'll never be able to do this stuff. And then the Lord provided Big Douglas to say, you don't have to do this stuff. What was this? And in the course of speaking about the way in which God would condescend to us and come down to his people, especially in their awareness of weakness, he told a lovely story of moving into the manse at the Free Church in St. Vincent Street in Glasgow, and how when they had moved down from the north, on the day of the flitting, they were moving books up into his study, which was on the first floor. And one of his boys, a little boy, offered to help his dad and wanted to carry stuff up the stairs. And Douglas said that he got him a few leaflets and just one or two things. He'd had some Scottish journals of theology or something tied up with string, and he had given them to him, and he and some others were going up and down the stairs around the landing and dropping big piles of books and coming back down. And on one occasion, as he came back down the stairs, he found that his son was on the first landing and he was crying. And he was crying in frustration, and he was overwhelmed by this big bundle that he had got for himself. He decided to advance his cause. He had moved beyond the Scottish Journal of Theology now. He was, I don't know what he had, E.J. Young's Analytical Concordance or a complete set of Kittle or something. And he was stuck on the landing and crying in frustration. And Douglas said that he looked at him and his first instinct was to say, well, why did you do what I didn't ask you to do? I mean, I gave you what you could handle. You didn't need to take yourself more than I would offer you. And he said, but I decided not to do that. And he said, I knelt down on the landing and I picked up my boy and I picked up his bundle and I carried them both safely to their destination. A wonderful picture of condescension. There was actually occasion for instruction and, you don't need to do this, you don't need to do that. But sometimes the part of a father is just to descend to the level of the request. And God in his grace here with his servant does exactly that. And that's how chapter 6 ends. Now if you've got the stomach for it, we'll just make a foray into 7. Do you? Amen. We're alright? Yeah. We'll just go. You're very gracious. Very foolish, but very gracious. When you go into chapter 7, you know this story. We've been doing it since Sunday school. When we look at a passage like this, we shouldn't immediately go to the high points and say we know everything about this. But the first question that I asked myself was, what's wrong with this picture? What's wrong with this picture? The picture of the forces surrounding, overwhelming picture of opposition. In fact, it says concerning the camp of Midian that, I think it's there in verse 12, the Midianites, the Amalekites and all the other eastern peoples that settled in the valley, thick as locusts. This is not a comment on their intellectual capacity. It's an indication of the quantity. And their camels could no more be counted than the sand on the seashore. It wasn't that they just couldn't count the people, they couldn't count the camels. And so what we're learning is this is a significant number. That is the opposition. And given the vastness of the opposition, the assessment which is given by God in verse 2 shows us what's wrong with the picture from a human perspective. The Lord said to Gideon, you've got too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands. Now he explains why, and unless you pay very careful attention to what he says, in order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her, if you're not listening carefully to his explanation, then you say to yourself, this doesn't make any sense at all. Gideon's got 32,000 people. Presumably, as he looks on them, he says, I wonder if 32,000 is going to be adequate against the opposition. And even the events that were that we've gone through in chapter 6 couldn't have prepared Gideon for what comes by way of answer to his unspoken question. The Lord says, you have too many. It doesn't make any sense at all, does it, until we understand the necessity of weakness. Until we understand that God's purpose for his people, for his servants, is that we depend upon him entirely. He's well aware of our proneness to rely upon ourselves, or on our methods, or traditions, or personalities, or gifts, or numbers, to congratulate ourselves on our cleverness, to rejoice in our contributions. And many times, the seeds of this can be discovered in some of the most unlikely situations. It's easy for those of us who are ministering away in certain environments to take pot shots at those who are in larger circumstances. I read of these churches in America, they're vast, and I look at them and I find the perversity of my heart is immediately looking for some explanation that devalues it in some way instead of rejoicing in it. And I think what I'm doing is I'm identifying the pride in my own heart. And of all pride, spiritual pride is the ugliest of all. That's why in 2 Corinthians 12, Paul is honest enough to say, you talk about being honest in your preaching later on, how honest is this? I, he says, can take on the super apostles if they want to talk experiences. Because I know a man who was caught up into the third heaven and he saw things that it's just so unbelievable that he could never really recount them. But in order to keep me from becoming conceited because of these surpassingly great revelations, there was given me a thorn in the flesh. Is it what Paul says? Because God knew I'd get a big head, he gave me a thorn in the flesh. Because he knew that having trusted me with this, he was going to have to leave me with that in order to counterbalance the impact and the potential for spiritual pride. And spiritual pride, and this is tangential now because I just went on to it. This is an illustration of what you shouldn't do. But just tangentially for a moment, surely spiritual pride is the ugliest of all. Because as John was saying last night in relationship to the danger of arrogance, If our eyes have been opened as a result of God's grace, if our grasp of things is as a result of God's revelation, if we were once like that, and now we are like this, Titus 2 or Titus 3, we'd have to check, then we have no basis for drawing attention to ourselves. And the same is true in terms of God's goodness to us in what he entrusts us with in ministry. So to boast of things or to find confidence in things which are as a result of God's unique bestowal to us is the worst kind of pride that we can ever have, because we didn't engender the situation in the first place. It was a gift from our Father. Well, where did you get that? Well, my dad gave it to me. Well, then don't be so boastful about it. You're making other people feel bad. Dad didn't give that to them. Now the whole principle here is that God is concerned to make sure that we know how weak we are so that we might discover how strong he is. Only by understanding how totally inadequate we are can we then discover the sufficiency of God. God wasn't concerned to avoid defeat. He was concerned to make sure that when victory came, everybody would know why. Everybody would know how. Now this two-stage reduction, because we go down quickly, don't we? Actually, very quickly. Poor Gideon. Incidentally, the background to this you can read of in Deuteronomy 20, because the law made provision for people going home. A variety of circumstances. We won't turn to it for now, but it's there. The law made provision if certain people, if they had married or if they had bought something or they needed to take care of something, the law said you can go home in that circumstance. And so Gideon, in keeping with that, makes the announcement according to God's directive. You should announce, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead. Can you imagine him standing up and saying, just to let you know, anybody who wants to shoot off, just slip out quietly at the back, just one or two of you, and two-thirds of his army starts heading out. Anybody afraid? It's not a trickle, this is a mass exodus. But it doesn't matter, because the morale of the army is actually more important than the size of the army. You'd be better with three good elders than 40 ones like stuffed dummies. Attitude and morale is crucial. Dependence, vital. And then, of course, in verse 4, when he's got it down to 10,000, the Lord said, we've still got too many. And then we have the lappers versus the kneelers, which, if you've ever preached a sermon on this, you should be taken out and shot. But the lappers and the kneelers story, one was lapping, the other was kneeling, the other was scooping. I've read this 100 times. I can't figure out who was doing what. I've diagrammed this and I still don't understand who was doing what. I can't picture lapping, kneeling, cupping. Forget it. I finally found Wilcock. He saved me from all my predicaments. He said, once we find ourselves asking why lapping was the sign of a better soldier, I am sure we are on the wrong track. And I said, good, that's terrific. That's the one quote I've been looking for. I'll forget that and keep moving. But it's still, having said that, it's not uncommon to hear this passage taught in such a way as to suggest that God is reducing the numbers so as to produce 300 Royal Marines. And he's got a plan to get these three rough and tumble characters, wise, brave chaps. He's looking for the crack troops. And that's the way it's taught in the church. I know a bunch of you will be going home. I know a crowd of you won't be coming to the evening service. Most of you don't show up at a prayer meeting. What a rabble you are. It's amazing what God can do. But I know there's a few of you, you know. There's a few good souls. There's me, Elijah, and a few of the rest of you. And it brings out the worst in everybody. I'll be with you, Pastor, yes. And that guy, he may be with you. He may put a knife in your back the following Thursday because of the way his personality is set. God is not doing that. In fact, can you imagine some of these big rugby players going home? Some of the 9,700 going back down the road? And one says to his friend, says, what are you going to tell your wife? And the other guy says, I don't know. That's the first time I got thrown out of an army for drinking wrong. I mean, this isn't for drinking beer. This is for drinking. This is not for drinking on duty. This is for how I drank the water. How are you supposed to drink the water? What did the other guys do? I don't know. My head was in the bucket. I couldn't tell. So I don't know. And then finally gets home and his wife says, you're home early, aren't you? Says, yeah, we got, a few of us got sent home. 31,700 already. Well, what was the problem? Well, I was getting a drink of water and the guy came up tap, said, that's enough for today. Now, what is God doing here? He's not getting it down to a particular kind of person. He's getting it down to a particular number of people. He gets it down to a number that is so small, so patently inadequate, that when they see the victory, they will not boast that they were saved by their own strength. Now again, we have to be very, very careful that we don't use this kind of material to glory in smallness. to teach this as the sort of antidote to church growth principles.
We don't like that stuff about success and progress. And no, we're the Gideon boys. You know, we're never happier than when the numbers are dwindling. There's nothing I like than a dwindling congregation, you know. Then I know I'm really doing it correctly. You know, it's not that at all. That's perverse also, isn't it? Once again, it comes back to the grace and patience of God with his servant. Having dealt with the two-stage reduction in verse 9, during that night, the Lord said to Gideon, I want you to get up and go down against the camp, because I'm going to give it into your hands. Just so you're wondering, because we've completely lost the place here, I had written down in my notes what's wrong with this picture, and then I had written the opposition and the assessment of things, and then I had written the two-stage reduction. So I wrote what's wrong with this picture, the opposition, the assessment, the two-stage reduction. And then my next heading was God's grace and patience with his servant, which comes out in the instruction that he gives here in verse 9 and following. Okay, Gideon, it's time. I'm going to give them into your hands. And again, God, in his kindness towards his servant, says to him, and verse 10, if you're afraid to attack, now he says, I know, Gideon, you like ifs. And so I have a little if for you. I want to say to you that if there's any possibility at all that you might be afraid. Not that I want to bring up to you, Gideon, the fact that after I sent you a prophet, told you I was with you, that you did that fleece business with me. I don't want to remind you of that at all, but I just want to say that if you are afraid to attack, see, God knows his children. Every good dad knows his children. God has compassion towards those he has made. Of course he knows Gideon. Of course he's afraid to attack. He's Gideon. Mighty warrior by designation, chicken by temperament. If you're afraid to attack, oh, I'm so thankful that you mentioned that. Just go down to the camp and take your servant Pura and listen to what they're saying. And I think you've pretty well discovered that you'll be encouraged as a result of that to attack. And so Gideon goes down and he listens in order that he might be encouraged, and they arrive, verse 13, just at the right moment, just as a man was telling his friend a dream. You imagine Hamlet, they're up on the ramparts there. Is that the opening scene in Hamlet? How goes the night? I'm not sure. How goes the night, boy? The moon is not yet up. Standing there, soldiers kicking their feet against the wall, talking to one another, saying, how have you been watching so-and-so? What have you been doing lately? And then eventually one of them says, you know, I had a big dream last night. So I said, really? He said, yes. Now at this point, we've got Pura and Gideon, and they've come on the situation. Here we've got two pagan soldiers speaking out of their own mouths and out of their own experience. Not automatons. Not wound up clockwork by God's intervention, not grabbed and sequestered and had something done to them, but just the unfolding of their lives as they recount it. You see how immense God is in taking all of the events of life and sweeping them into his unfolding purpose, ultimately of redemption. Yeah, I was dreaming, and a big loaf of barley bread came tumbling into the Midianite camp, and it struck the tent with such force that the tent overturned and collapsed. And his friend says, oh, I can tell you what that is. He said, what? Oh, yeah, I know what that is. What is that? He says, that's nothing other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, the Israelite. God has given the Midianites and the whole camp into our hands. And when Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he was ready to go. Now, the point is straightforward. What are the odds of a loaf knocking down a tent? About the same as 300 people defeating the vastness of the Midianite armies. There's not a chance in a war. They have a dog's chance and no chance of victory from that perspective.
And when Gideon heard the dream and his interpretation, he said, I've got to write a book about this. When Gideon heard the dream and his interpretation, he said, I can't wait to get this out on the internet. When Gideon heard the dream and his interpretation, he worshipped God. This fearful, fragile, unlikely leader pours out his heart in praise to God. I wonder all that that meant. I don't know what it meant. I don't know if he walked away for a moment. I don't know if he was, if there's a gap of time there, even a half an hour or whatever. Who knows? Maybe it's only in his heart. We don't know. But the fantastic thing about it is that we're told that his reaction to it was to give praise and glory to God. In other words, this is the unseen part of leadership. This is the secret bit. This is the crucial bit. And it is this part in the secret place, in the response to God's goodness to his servant, that makes possible his ability to do what he then does. Because when he steps out in front of the people now, given the vastness of the challenge, given the impoverished nature of the group, he does lead boldly, doesn't he? He's very bold. He's very clear. He's very decisive. People could be forgiven for thinking that he was a wee bit at himself, as they say in Glasgow. That somehow or another, you know, he was a wee bit cocksure of himself. But he wasn't. Let them think what they like at this point. Because there's an army to be faced. There's a battle to be fought. There's a victory to be won. So he can't worry about what they think about his personality and his directive style of leadership and whether he's bold or assertive or whether he's issuing instructions, because in the secret place where God knows him, he knows who he is. He knows he's totally inadequate. He knows it's God's intervention by his word in the kindness of his servant that has caused him to worship God from his heart, that has put him on the stage of history with boldness. And one of the great missing elements, brethren, in many of our ministries is a boldness that comes not from our personalities, not from our giftedness, not from our assertiveness, but a boldness that even takes us by surprise. A boldness that comes from the quietness, from the silence, from the secret, from the tiny phrase, he worshipped God. You see, McShane said it, didn't he? What a man is on his knees before God, that's what he is, and nothing else. God knows what we are. We don't have to explain anything to him. He made us. He fashioned us. He called us. He enabled us. So we can be dead honest in our preaching. Lord, I'm afraid of this preaching. Lord, I'm not properly prepared for this preaching. Lord, whatever it is. Lord, I don't even know what my motivation is in this preaching. I don't know whether I would be gratified to think that people thought it was good more than concerned to do a faithful exposition of the text. Lord, I only want to get to 12 o'clock. I'm just looking forward to my lunch. I'm so looking forward to my lunch. I can't wait to finish my sermon. And they think that I'm coming with divine energy. I am the most reluctant, pathetic piece of material that has crawled into this pulpit in a long while. And you know that. And if you don't exalt your name and your word, if you don't show yourself strong, if you, the God that can speak through Balaam's donkey, don't come and speak through me today, then they're all going to find out. Or is this just me? I don't know. Get up, he says, ! Get organized and do what I do. Watch me, follow me, and when we get to the point, do what I do. This is leadership. Now again, someone comes on this scene and says, wow, Gideon, what happened to Gideon? Where did he come away with that? Okay, let's get organized, let's get up, let's get divided, let's get the trumpets, let's get the jars, let's get the torches in place. And at the end of the day, this is what I want you to do. And the last thing I wrote down were the sights and sounds of victory. Because that's really where the story ends, with these wonderful sights and these terrific sounds. Verse 18, when I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp I want you to blow yours and shout for the Lord and for Gideon. And Gideon and the 100 men with him reached the edge of the camp, so we know the 200 were elsewhere. At the beginning of the middle watch, just after they had changed the guard, strategic, not just haphazard, he obviously gave some thought to this. He said, well, doesn't matter, God doesn't care, the more idiotic we are, the better we can be used, you know, let's just stumble and bumble into it, don't let's give any thought to it, after all, you know, I had the fleece, I had the angel, I've had a lot of stuff, it doesn't, no, he said, we better think about this properly, because the odds still don't look very good, I know God has said this, but let's do our best. And they blew their trumpets and broke the jars that were in their hands, and the three companies blew the trumpets and smashed the jars, and the sword for the Lord and for Gideon, and while each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. I think this is really quite funny, this little picture. I can imagine him having said, let's just have a dummy run before we go. Let's do parts 1 and 3, but don't break the jars. I said, don't break the jars. Would you listen? How are we going to do anything with this? Man, what a group. Don't break the jars. Let's do part 1, part 3 without the jar breaking. Let's try it. So they try it. Another clown breaks the jar. This is impossible. Okay. Let me ask you a question. This little scene here, how much military expertise is necessary for this execution?
Not a lot.
This isn't Sandhurst. No. This isn't the military academy. You know. Who needs Marines for this? See, again, come back to the thing. The way we talk, the way we train, the way we look for our replacements, the way we think to fill our pulpits, we're looking for adequacy. We're looking for effectiveness. We're looking for the thing. And God comes into the wine press and he says, Gideon, you're a mighty warrior, aren't you? He said, No, I'm not. He said, no, I know you're not either, but I just wanted to call you that for a moment. Well, why would we be surprised? Are we surprised that God would use such an unlikely servant? We shouldn't be. He uses us. We're surprised that God would use such a picture of weakness and futility? No. Doesn't he use frustration and failure? Illness? As the very instruments of his rule? Against all odds, he uses Gideon and a scrappy force. But yet, who would have thought that when he became flesh, that he would be one from whom men hid their faces, despised and rejected of men? So when we're tempted to push to the front with our credentials, let's remember again the nature of this paradox, that when we're weak, then we're strong. As Paul says in 2 Corinthians, there is a 1 Corinthians, I can never remember, says that we have this treasure in old clay pots, so that the transcendent power might be seen to belong to God and not to us. And we don't want to go into the spiritualizing of having our lives smashed and so on. But it is quite a good little chorus, isn't it? Spirit of the living God, fall afresh on me. Break me. Melt me. Mold me. Use me. Father, we want to thank you for the chance to open our Bibles. We want to thank you for the privilege of thinking together and trying to stimulate one another's thoughts to depend upon you entirely. Some of us perhaps feel as though this reinforces only what we have been so glaringly confronted with in recent days. Others of us feel that the bubble of our pride is pricked and that we have been looking to places other than yourself as we've thought of the vastness of the challenge that we face and of the
victories that we long to see. And we thank you, even as we dip into Judges, it reminds us that as much as the people have benefited from these leaders, they essentially ended the day saying these leaders are okay for a while, but there must be another leader. And the book ends pointing us forward eventually to the one who will come out of the tumble-down events of a little backwater province and a funny little village called Bethlehem. And out of this unlikely spot, out of this peculiar little winepress, would come forth one who would be the ruler of his people, Israel. We thank you then that as we ponder this, that we see ourselves to be in the great continuum of your redemptive purposes, and that you will help us so to look to Christ and to rest in him and to bow before his word, that you will grant to us a genuine holy boldness, irrespective of our temperament or our personality, whether it is with quiet confidence, whether it is with zealous extravagance, whatever way, Lord, we do pray that you will grant us grace, having met with you, having been reminded again of what we cannot do, being confronted by the wonder of what you have done, that you will help us to say to our people, come on, let's get up. Follow my lead as I follow Christ. And then let's take on this fast on. To this end, we give ourselves into your care, and I ask you to bless and help us in the various aspects of the day that are before us. And we do so with glad and thankful hearts in Jesus' name. Amen.